This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. It's 7:33. Because of the fracking boom, Shell is considering building a large petrochemical plant in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, near the West Virginia border. Last week, Governor Tomlin announced that a Brazilian company is considering such a complex in Wood County. Odebrecht also wants to take advantage of the Marcellus Shale gas boom. In Louisiana, such a gas boom has already led to a renaissance for the state's large chemical industry. What does a chemical building boom look like? In the third of four reports from the Gulf Coast, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found jobs fueling the chemical boom in Louisiana are abundant, but they can also be dangerous.
On a rainy morning, Mike Eads drives around Geismar, Louisiana. It's about halfway between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and it's in the middle of Louisiana's so-called Chemical Corridor. It's a 60-mile stretch along the Mississippi River where roughly a quarter of the country's petrochemicals are made. Eads points out several large construction projects at hulking industrial plants. Eads is director of the local development corporation. His job is to bring new business to the area. He pulls over. Workers in the distance are preparing a site for construction.
This is about a 225-acre site.
The site will house two plants for Methanex. Methanex is the world's largest producer of methanol, a basic chemical made from natural gas. The total price for the project is over $1 billion, but the price itself isn't the most eye-popping thing about these new plants.
They are just actually dismantling another plant in Chile and moving it to this area.
Eads has been in this business for 30 years, and he's worked in seven different states. In the last year alone, he's seen about $3.6 billion in new announced projects here.
So, and that's by far the most that I've ever experienced in my career in any location.
These projects are all happening because of the fracking boom. It's made natural gas cheap and abundant, and chemical companies use natural gas as a raw material. While the boom comes at a good time for the region's economy, people here also know these plants can be dangerous. This fact was driven home one morning in June. Antoinette West was lying on her couch in Geismar.
The house shook, and I got up, and I went to the door.
She thought it was an explosion at a nearby vinyl plant, which caught fire last year, but she couldn't see any smoke when she looked in that direction. Then she looked behind her trailer.
All I seen was black smoke.
A massive explosion and fire at a chemical plant rocks the Geismar.
It was the Williams Olefins plant in Geismar. One worker died in the explosion, and another died the next day from his injuries. Over 100 were hurt. The plant makes ethylene and propylene. It's the same kind of plant, an ethane cracker, that Shell Chemical is proposed building in western Pennsylvania. Ethylene and propylene are the building blocks of plastic and other chemicals. They're also highly flammable. The company said a rupture in a heat exchanger caused the explosion. For West, it was another moment where she wished she didn't have to live so close to a chemical plant.
If I could move today, I would move. I'm not gonna lie. I would get out of here.
But this is the only place she can afford. The company reported releasing 31,000 pounds of chemicals in the blast, mostly propylene, which can burn the eyes and skin. But the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, the state regulator, said that its air monitoring taken that day showed no unsafe levels of chemicals in the air near the plant. Leroyal Ely lives two doors down from West. He's an electrician who's worked in many of the plants in the area. As his family gets ready for dinner one night, he says he isn't worried about air pollution from the explosion.
I didn't think nothing really seriously would happen to me over here. I was worried about the people in there.
But his wife, Elaine Claiborne, says she was concerned about what came out of the plant during the blast.
It might not affect us right now, but later on in the year, yeah, I got concerned.
Ely says worries about pollution or explosions are just something you have to live with if you live near a chemical plant. He says, overall, it's worth it.
It's good to have them, but it's a risk in everything.
Those risks are why the industry needs stronger oversight, says Kim Nyberger. He's with the United Steelworkers, which represents thousands of chemical and refinery workers.
take a coffee can and fill it about half full of gas and put it on your barbecue. That's not much different than what's going on in these facilities. It's a dangerous, dangerous operation.
The Obama administration is paying closer attention to the issue of chemical safety. In August, the president signed an executive order mandating greater communication and enforcement among federal agencies who oversee chemical plants. He was responding to a fertilizer explosion in April in West Texas. That blast killed 15. Despite high-profile explosions, the chemical manufacturing industry is comparatively safe, according to records from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The industry has a fatality rate roughly half the national average for other industries, and it's much, much safer than jobs like mining, forestry, or farming. But Nyberger says those numbers can be deceiving.
No, I think the industry is more dangerous than it seems.
That's because those injury and fatality rates don't always include contractors working at the plant. When those are accounted for, he says those injury numbers are actually higher. But an industry trade group says even if outside workers are taken into account, the chemical sector is relatively safe, and it's getting safer. The American Chemistry Council says its members have had a precipitous drop in accidents, 58% since the 1990s. Scott Jensen of the Chemistry Council says those numbers include contractors.
While I think in the public's mind that there is a renewed focus on safety, I think for our industry, that focus has always been there.
Concern over safety issues aren't likely to stop the chemical expansion anytime soon. In Geismar, the plants keep growing to take advantage of cheap shale gas. And they're attracting workers like Joshua Gray. Gray moved here from Baton Rouge to work as a carpenter. On a recent afternoon, he stopped in a parking lot on his way out of a laundromat.
The economic part of it is outstanding. The money's here. There's no reason to leave here. I mean, you're going to make some money right here. For the next 10 years, it's equivalent to a gold rush.
Gray was with Josh Gibbons, an 18-year-old from Baton Rouge. Last week, Gibbons was delivering pizzas. Now he's working as a carpenter's apprentice.
Learn. I'm there for learning, really. I'm there for the money, but I mean, it's not that great at the moment.
Because what's the money like now?
14 an hour starting right now, but it's the first time in a plant.
18 years old,
but,
he beat it.
You know, he was delivering pizzas a week ago, and now he's making
checks a week.
$140 a day.
The irony of all this for Joshua Gray is he's not really in favor of the expansion. He thinks the plants are releasing too much air pollution and that they're bad for the environment.
I know I don't really in favor none of it. It's not good for the environment. It's really terrible. But, you know, when you need a job, you're going to do what you got to do to make money.
And Gray says he'll be here as long as the money keeps coming. In Geismar, Louisiana, I'm Reed Frazier for the Allegheny Front.
This project is supported in part by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. In his final report tomorrow, Reed Frazier looks at how one Louisiana town is reacting to a plant similar to the one Shell proposes building in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, and Odebrecht is considering building in Wood County, West Virginia. Well, back here in West Virginia, state lawmakers say they're starting to broaden their focus of the state's water resources from not just protecting it, but also managing it. During a legislative interim meeting in Charleston, legislators considered the thoughts of scientists and industry leaders regarding wastewater management in the natural gas sector. Ashton Mara reports.
Fresh water is becoming more and more of an issue, not just here in West Virginia or Appalachia, but throughout the country and throughout the world. It's becoming more scarce.
Senate Majority Leader Senator John Unger began the discussion during a meeting of the Joint Legislative Oversight Commission on State Water Resources.
I think we've been blessed with this water resource because we do have abundance of it. But we're also, it's also a finite, it's not infinite, and we want to leverage it for economic development. So we want to be able to utilize this to attract companies into our state and to better manage it.
Even though water isn't the main attraction for industry in the state, drilling for natural gas in northern West Virginia depends on the availability of the resource. According to recent research, each Marcellus well in West Virginia requires the injection of about 5 million gallons of water. Water is mixed with various chemicals, pressurized and pumped pump down into wells to release the gas from the Marcellus Shale during the fracking process, making water a critical component.
There will never be a well drilled in the Appalachian Basin without water management.
Rick Zikafoos is the Vice President of Operations for Green Hunter Water.
You've got to have water. You've got to manage the water. You've got to know where you're going to get it to begin with and know what you're going to do with it when it's done.
And when it is done, that's when Green Hunter's work begins. The company trucks used frack water from drilling sites in West Virginia and Ohio to one of their five disposal wells in West Virginia, Ohio, or Kentucky, or one of their holding facilities to await injection. Zikafoos says they inject around 75,000 barrels of wastewater a week, or about 750 truckloads. But now, he says the company wants to diversify their wastewater management methods.
We are taking the steps to go ahead and go into the water recycling arena.
Water use data collected by the State Department of Environmental Protection reveals that of the 5 million gallons of water injected into each well, only about 8% returns to the surface as wastewater or flowback. New recycling practices adopted in the state are diverting about 75% of that waste for reuse. Zikafoos says simply providing the surface of processing wastewater for reuse isn't enough for the industry to make the full transition away from fresh water, at least not yet. Today, oil and gas companies rely on injection wells to dispose of wastewater as sanctioned by the state because of something Zikafoos refers to as cradle-to-grave regulations. Basically, the regulations make companies accountable for water from the second they collect it at the freshwater source until it's disposed of at the injection well. But Melissa Pagan, water treatment specialist for Green Hunter, says they can offer an alternative.
But they drop off their product. We have a tank cleaning on site so they can clean the inside of the tank because that's regulation. Then they can take water that we've already treated. That's taking one extra truck off the road that would have to carry water to frack with that we're providing for free.
But Pagan says there is a hesitation from the industry on mixing their water with that of other companies at the recycling site and still having the liability if something should happen. Zikafoos says whether it's through regulations or a shift in the industry, he still believes the recycling technology his company can offer will be utilized in the near future. So confident, in fact, Green Hunter has already bought a site in Wheeling to build a holding facility and recycling center. Dr. Ben Stout, a professor of biology at Wheeling Jesuit University, has been outspoken against the new site because of its location, only miles upstream from the city's drinking water intake location on the Ohio River. Stout maintains should an accident occur, it jeopardizes not only the water source for the citizens of Wheeling, but also for millions of other people in cities in West Virginia and other states downstream. He also raises concerns about the additional truck traffic brought into the residential area where the facility would be located. Stout, however, is a proponent of the recycling program.
The waste stream is the Achilles heel of the industry. And so the limiting to production is eventually going to be the limit to how fast you can clean your after yourself. And so I think Green Hunter's right on. I support them. And I hope they can develop the kind of technologies and processes that would really, really work.
Technologies and a process that would really work, he adds, in the proper locations. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:47. Sunny skies today. Temperatures in the 40s and 50s, mostly clear and cold overnight with lows in the 20s and 30s. Partly cloudy tomorrow with temperatures remaining in the 40s and 50s.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure healthy populations of marine life in the Atlantic at pewtrusts.org.
This is National Homeless and Hunger Awareness Week, when the National Coalition for the Homeless and other advocacy organizations hope the country will focus on issues surrounding poverty. The United Way of the Eastern Panhandle is doing just that tomorrow evening during a public forum. Cecilia Mason reports.
During the forum Poverty in the Panhandle, Children at Risk, the United Way, Family Resource Network, and Health and Human Services Collaborative hope to discuss the problem and come up with possible solutions. Jefferson County Delegate Tiffany Lawrence has been working with State Senator John Unger to address child poverty. She says there's a perception that the Eastern Panhandle doesn't have much of a problem.
Many times I think people think that the Eastern Panhandle is a bedroom community of Washington, D.C., as we often hear, and then our socioeconomic status is elevated for some reason or another. But truly, that's not the case in all parts of the Panhandle. And we do see children and also adults and families really suffering from a lack of stability, whether that's financial stability, a lack of job skills, parenting skills, things that lead into the cycle of poverty.
There will be group discussions with the goal of coming up with a plan to address the problem. Sharon Awkward is Director of Community Impact with the United Way. She hopes the forum will lead to a heightened awareness of how poverty affects the community.
If people are constantly living in poverty, they may have no jobs, they can become incarcerated, they can move totally out of the area. Now, what does that leave us with? Nothing. So poverty affects the entire community, and we cannot constantly go on and put it on the back burner. This is something that's real, and this is something that we can tackle, and this is something that we can do something about.
The forum will feature a viewing of the PBS documentary Poor Kids and a preview of a West Virginia Public Broadcasting documentary that will focus on child poverty within the state. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason in Martinsburg.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Beth Voorhees.